You are listening to Beyond the Jargon, a jargon-free look at graduate students and their research journeys here at UVic.
Welcome to Beyond the Jargon. I'm your host, Liz MacArthur. Joining me today, David Christopher, PhD candidate here at the University of Victoria in History and Art, but also culture and cinema.
That's right.
Thank you for being my guest today. It's nice to have you here.
Thanks, Liz, very much for having me.
I always read a little bit about my guests before they come in, mm-hmm. and I have to say you have a pretty extensive academic career so far,
yes.
Lots of degrees, so you've been part of the Academy for a while, but let's talk about what you're specifically focusing on here at UVic.
Okay, well, I've been at UVic for a while, but currently I'm working, as you said, with cinema under Dr. Leanne McClarty in the History and Art Department. She's an expert in cinema. She was publishing in such, you know, renowned Canadian books as Take Two as early as 1986. She deals with feminism, postmodernism, and cinema theory in general. She gives a wide range of courses. And under her tutelage, I'm focusing on the Toronto New Wave. These are our directors like Jeremy Podwaysa and Don McKellar, and their apocalyptic films in particular. That's my current focus, but I mean, I'm not even focusing on that right now. Right now, I'm doing comprehensive examinations. So,
right.
But I'm actually in the middle of my Canadian cinema history comprehensive examination. So it's timely in that regard.
Yeah. that's interesting. I don't know anything about the directors you just named.
That would make you Canadian.
Right, yeah. Yeah, this is a thing. I mean, we live in Canada. Former job, different radio station I worked at, there was a show where they reviewed movies, and I remember saying to somebody that I had been watching a lot of foreign films lately, mm-hmm. and the guy host of the show was saying, well, 90% of what you watch is foreign films because we're not American. You probably watch a lot of Hollywood stuff, which I was like, yeah, that's true. I don't watch a lot of Canadian films, I don't think.
I don't think in terms of mainstream culture, a lot of people do. One of the common criticisms of Canadian film is that it's really popular in the Academy. It's always suffered from not finding a domestic audience. This is the swan song of Canadian cinema history, going back into the earliest parts of the 20th century. The negotiations that the government made with Hollywood or with the American government variously were never really the types of negotiations that fostered a domestic industry. It's easy to say that you know, they negotiated poorly, but they didn't negotiate poorly. They made decisions that seemed timely, but in effect killed our cinema industry, at least for public distribution. Even today, there's substantial American control of Canadian cinema for exhibition. That's the theaters I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But underneath all of that, we have a rich and interesting and in some ways substantially socialist cinema tradition here in Canada. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of the National Film Board of Canada.
Yeah.
Everyone has heard of that. If you were a kid and you went to a museum, you know, you're at least familiar with the National Film Board. We have an amazing canon of Canadian cinema. And out of that organization, of course, we have a wide range of narrative cinema. And as we approached the 21st century, and moving into the new millennium, we've got a wide range of young, exciting filmmakers who are doing amazing things, and they've made some amazing films. In fact, a lot of the films that you probably think are American are actually Canadian. You know, The Sweet Hereafter is a famous film by Adam McGoyan, of course, a Canadian film. Last Night by Don McKellar, a Canadian film. And then there's the highly commercialized ones that were sold in the American markets. Porky's is actually a Canadian film. Hmm. Meatballs is a Canadian film. These are the types of Canadian films that have traditionally sort of effaced the Canadian presence in order to try and attract an American distribution market, or because this was required by the American powers who were involved in production. But we also have a strong Canadian tradition where effacing Canada is not part of the agenda, although it tends to be ironic. That's one of the catchwords to discuss Canadian cinema, and self-denigrating.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit self-denigrating, which I think is a function of our cultural position, at least in the global market. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's so appealing to you about the two directors specifically that you mentioned and the films of theirs that you're looking at?
I have to be honest, they were the first two off the top of my head from the reading I did 10 minutes before I came in here.
Right.
But I will admit that Don McKellar is of particular interest to me. You know, typical of a lot of Canadian talent, he straddles the border. He moves back and forth between American productions, but unlike and Canadian productions, unlike certain famed Canadians like Jim Carrey or Mike Myers, you know, he's amongst a group of actor, director, filmmakers who straddles the border back again. You know, he comes back, and a lot of his work is made in Canada and has certainly what might be called a Canadian inflection. And what I observed in the Toronto New Wave, you know, Deepa Mehta is considered part of the Toronto New Wave. Same with Bruce McDonald. These are other big-name Canadian filmmakers. So you're talking, there's one article by Piers Handling available online, which says there's no real unity to this group. They sort of were educated in the 80s in Toronto, mm-hmm. not even at the same institution necessarily, and they started to make their reputations in the late 80s and the early 90s, and he claims there's not a lot of unity. Another writer, David Pike, claims that there is some kind of a unity amongst this group called the Toronto New Wave. Although he's vague about it. And I observed that a percentage of them, I found 7 or 8, and there's about 20 of them in the population, cut their teeth or made their reputations on cinema that specifically deals with apocalypse. And of course, apocalypse is a rising aesthetic in terms of popularity.
Mm-hmm.
In the new millennium, you know, we're facing new types of apocalypse, the American movies of the late 90s, the cycles which sort of displaced responsibility for inevitable apocalypse onto, you know, interstellar phenomena or you know, globalization changes, and always American ingenuity was the solution with sort of ludicrous, impossible spacecraft that could land on meteors and that type of thing. The Canadian apocalypse movies, typical of a long history of sort of Canadian nihilism in cinema, they're not quite so jubilant in a faith in the American industrial project to sort of save the world.
Mm-hmm.
Last Night, for example, is a tongue-in-cheek, ironic, sort of fun social drama, counting down the last hours to the end of the world. There's no specific indication how the world is going to end. This is a 1998 film participating from Canada with this late 90s cycle of American films. It seems to be you know, a heavenly object of some kind. Late at night, there's no darkness. Maybe some sort of a sun flare or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no hint in the narrative of anyone trying to avert
mm-hmm.
with some sort of ludicrous fantasy of industrial might. Everyone is just sort of figuring out how they're going to spend the last hours of their lives. And it has a lot of a subtle comic moments, a typical Canadian male lead who is sort of weak and sort of quirky, played against, that's Don McKellar playing in his own film, against Sandra Oh, who is another straddle the border, but who has located herself substantially in America more than McKellar has located himself back here in Canada. And of course, she's such a brilliant actress and such a strong actress. Of course, she's the stronger presence, although more melodramatic, more emotional, where he is more quirky, dealing with sort of an inverted masculinity. A lot of tropes here, right? I mean, a lot of conventions going on. And they count down to the end of the world. And it ends. I mean, as far as we know, it's a fade to wash at the end. And and it's one of a whole series. You know, you've got guys like Bruce LaBruce, for example, whose work was banned because it's effectively homosexual pornography, gay porn.
Mm.
But of course, it's so much more than that. I mean, this is really rich social commentary. He's got a couple of films about zombies, homosexual zombies, gay zombies. One of them is a really art house avant-garde piece. The first one, I can't even remember the name. It's the name of the character who may or may not be a zombie. He's convinced that he is. And of course, there's a lot of meta cinema going on. He stars in a film in the film, and it makes a lot of really great social commentary. He followed that up, LeBruce did, several years later with another piece called L.A. Zombie, which is much, it's stylized in a very different way. And it's set in L.A. It's unabashed about showing sort of the detritus side of the glamorous city that American films are not renowned for. I'm not saying they don't exist, but of course that's not what how they've made their reputation. And he moves in and out, the main lead character moves in and out of a number of strange demon zombie-like characters as he engages in one after another homosexual gay experience. But there's almost no dialogue in the film, but it's just rich in meaning, although the critics kind of panned it compared to his first one. It doesn't appear to be as sophisticated, but you know, when you're dealing with zombies, you are at least peripherally in the apocalypse genre. Right? My advisor, Dr. McClarty, she insists that apocalypse is a subcategory of horror. And there's sound reason to make that assertion, although I think that apocalypse has developed into its own genre. You know, genre is not a great way to delineate the aesthetics or certainly the cultural significance or critical significance of a film, except to locate it, you know, maybe temporally and aesthetically. It gives you sort of a foundation to work with. But I'm claiming in my contemporary work that there is an apocalyptic aesthetic unique to Canada. Yeah.
Why are we so involved in this apocalypse? Or as you mentioned before, Canadian nihilism in film. Like, what's that about? Why are we so dark?
You know, I wish I could tell you. I grew up a pretty happy kid, as far as I know. You know, Canada is, again, as far as I know, reputed as being clean and generally friendly. You know, there's the old stereotype of if you're an American traveling in Paris, make sure you have a maple leaf on your shirt because then you'll get better service. I don't know that that's true. I can't speak to that. But, you know, I think that a lot of the critics, I'm not making this claim myself, but it seems like it's an astute understanding. A lot of the critics or theorists that have examined Canadian cinema have looked at our position as, you know, Northrop Frye, Atwood. She says that survival and colonialism. But this might be a colonial footprint that is somewhat dated in the 21st century. Most of the people I know have the urban experience as their childhood, or at least the suburban experience, you know. And films like, there's a werewolf film with a couple of young girls, Ginger Snaps, deals with, at the outset, it sort of criticizes the suburban myth of security. But this is not unique to Canada. Criticizing the suburban myth in horror film is, it may well be ascribed to American conventions at the outset. But, you know, our position is as doubly colonized, it's called. You know, originally we have the colonial footprint from the British heritage. And then we have a dominating, even invasive American media presence, like you and I have laughed about. My experience with media as a child was less Canadian programming. It was less Mr. Dress-Up, and it was more Sesame Street. You know, we are largely indoctrinated on American popular cinema, perhaps more than television, but certainly we are. And I think that position, you know, if you are in an industry that is always already sort of in a marginal position, perhaps a subservient position, and some of the producers even a sycophantic position against the more powerful American media. And you have a cultural heritage that dates back to sort of a deferral to colonialism. You know, the Americans, at least historically, have their moment of emancipation. You know, we sort of said, you know, we'll stay a colony. And then I think it was in the 70s that Trudeau brought back the Constitution. that was not a celebrated moment in Canadian history. I remember it happening. I think I was about 7 years old. And and I thought, you know, I remember asking my mother, what's going to change? You know, nothing. Great. Is there cake? You know, okay, so forget it. I don't care. I'm seven. And so I think a lot of these things. And then, you know, as a filmmaker working under those conditions, I think that that identity crisis finds, you know, aesthetic expression in our film. That coupled with the fact that low budgets, poor backing, the knowledge that you're not going to get any sort of distribution, I think this creates sort of an underdog, nihilistic mentality amongst filmmakers. That's a broad generalization. I don't mean to suggest there's no levity, there's no buoyancy. You know, Last Night is an apocalypse film, like I mentioned, with substantial buoyancy. You'll laugh as you're being painfully disturbed by the narrative that you watch. And I think that the social agenda, which is typical of documentary film, and because we had such a strong documentary tradition out of the National Film Board of Canada from 1939, when Grierson was put in place as a supervisor more than a filmmaker, although he ended up taking on that role, and then as one of our Canadian heroes in terms of film. He, of course, wasn't Canadian. He was Scottish. This is another typical colonial footprint in our identity. And then he, for all intents and purposes, you know, left the country under the Igor Gizenko scandal, you know, being called a communist at the time of high tensions following the World War, the Second World War. And that documentary tradition of social realism and social indoctrination, always having a message, that's kind of nihilistic. I mean, you know, there's not much value in a social realist film which is celebrating how wonderful capitalism is. Right. I mean, that's called an American fantasy. Generally, that's called American fantasy, although we have Canadian fantasies that are like that as well. And so these are some of the greatest hits amongst the theorists that have sort of resolved, I think, into a proud celebration of our nihilism and our marginal positioning as a cinema industry. And I think that the younger filmmakers, you know, like McKellar, Sarah Pauley, certainly Jeremy Podwaza, who's done a lot of work directing American television. He directed an episode of who's the serial killer who's a police officer. Do you know this television?
Oh, Dexter.
He directed an episode of Dexter. And of course Adam McGoyan, who might not be called a young filmmaker anymore, but he's done some wonderfully buoyant things with incredibly nihilistic narratives. And then you take Cronenberg, you know, who's in some ways the epitome of Canadian film in a number of ways. One, he's in a medium which is considered entirely not Canadian, at least his early stuff, a horror film, which was frowned upon. Another one of the big famous critics in the 60s and 70s, when Cronenberg was making his name, a guy named Delaney made his reputation by publishing an article. I think the title of it was You Should Know How Bad This Film Is After All You Paid For It, because Cronenberg was making films with Canadian public funding. Shivers, though, was a great film with a lot of satire and irony. It's as satirical as it is scary, if it's scary at all. It's apocalyptic. At the end, of course, it's got an aperture where obviously the virus is going to spread into greater Montreal and presumably the rest of the world. It's an early sort of change or twist on the zombie narratives, which had not even come into their own except with who's the famous zombie guy?
Oh, I'm so bad with
names. I'm at a loss in the middle of an interview. But you know, Cronenberg was a Canadian version of establishing these conventions, and there's a lot of fun in these movies. But some of the critics say, you know, you'd only get it if you're Canadian, and otherwise, I can't remember the name of the critic who says it, but it says there's a lot of fun in Canadian films, sure, but otherwise we make sad, pathetic films that nobody anywhere else would ever want to see. although we have huge popularity in the international film festivals.
This was something I was thinking about here. You know, we talk about, or you were mentioning, like, you're not going to get distribution. There's these low budgets. Yeah. As Canadians, people aren't even aware of your film.
Yeah.
So who do Canadian filmmakers make films for? Is it people in the academy that are studying them, or, yeah, international film festivals?
You know, the Canadian government made a lot of changes in the twilight years of the 20th century. And there's been a tectonic shift in the possibilities for distribution. And part of that is playing into the fact that American distribution is slowly being sort of whittled away. I mean, it's still dominant. I don't mean to suggest hegemony is not in place. It is. But, you know, film festivals have been on the rise for 20 years, and Canadian fare has typically been popular in film festivals. And I think that Canadian filmmakers 30, 40 years ago, you know, not Cronenberg, who obviously had a commercial agenda and succeeded, but he's an anomaly. Filmmakers are Bruce Elder and the French unit at the NFB were making avant-garde, experimental, even narrative films that I think they knew were either going to find local domestic markets popular in Quebec. Quebec certainly has a highly commercial, self-sustaining industry, but it's insular, you know. Bon Cop, Bad Cop, went across the border. We all liked that. It was easier to enjoy if you were bilingual. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to have subtitles for the parts of the film that were in French or English on the other side of the border. Mm-hmm. So I think they were making socialist films. In the following the Gazenko scandal, the NFB acquired a reputation of being either a mouthpiece for the Mackenzie King and Saint Laurent governments, or for being communists. And while this, not unduly, I mean, they were making socialist films. Communist doesn't carry with it the Red Scare weight that it did in the, you know, even as late as the 1980s. Now we think of communism as a potential economic progression, you know, for economic thinkers, I think. But at that time, of course, communism was a frightening notion, and to be labeled as such was, you know, a suicide for American distribution, most certainly. So I don't know who they expected to market these films to, but they're being recovered from anonymity, from the annals of history where they were sort of shelved and nobody thought they would ever be looked at, and now we're beginning to see some of the significance of these films as part of the larger political cultural milieu of things that were going on in the 60s and 70s. You know, we have the FLQ crisis in 1970. There was a huge fallout of cinema, especially in Quebec, that was obviously directly influenced by the political scars caused by such an event. And then we have the contemporary filmmakers who are not afraid, of course, of the film festival circuit. I think that they identify with it substantially. It's part of a heritage, and because it's becoming so popular. But a lot of these films are getting public distribution. Mm-hmm. You know, the aesthetic boundary, the American film is all fantasy and spectacle. The Canadian film is all social realism. I think these boundaries under postmodernism, perhaps, are becoming blurred. You know, there's so much variety in any film. The Americans, it's not like they've never been making social realist films. They have a tradition. And while Canadians are not renowned for blockbuster special effects, you know, multi-million dollar film projects are no longer unheard of. Mm. You know, they're happening. So
yeah.
I think 20 years from now, Canadians will know Canadian films a lot better than they did 20 years ago.
Interesting. Are you among a large group of people that study Canadian cinema? And are the people that do study Canadian cinema largely Canadian? Or are there people from outside that are interested in the stuff?
Yes and yes. Mm-hmm. I am amongst a large group of people that study Canadian cinema.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not like a lot of people who are still doing their academic work. I am substantially isolated. We tend to know each other through academic sharing technology online. And I would hesitate to say that I'm contemporary with big names like you know, Brenda Longfellow, who is working, I think, in Ontario now. She's published a number of pieces on Canadian film. And there's a whole range of Canadian film academes, I guess. But I won't really enjoin that discourse until, you know, my work is a little further along than it is. Mm-hmm. But I know there's a lot of them because I have to read all of their papers in order to participate, even at this level. And yes, most of them are in Canadian universities, I would say. Occasionally, there is an American name that is obviously interested in Canadian film. But for the most part, it's Canadians talking about Canadians. Mm-hmm. For the time being.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we're making our mark on the historical record. And I think that it will begin to garner increasing international attention or perhaps acclaim in the coming years.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of, I mean, you see some Canadians becoming quite commercially successful mm-hmm. and getting recognition at, say, like Oscars, awards, like big awards like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really important, do you think, for Canadian cinema? Does that matter? Or should we just continue to sort of do the stuff that we're good at and what we're kind of known for?
You know, nobody wants an award until they might win one.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak to that. I don't know how they feel. You know, in interviews that you see with guys like Egoyan, McKellar, Pauly, they seem pretty down-to-earth people,
mm-hmm.
you know. I don't think they get up in the morning looking for awards.
Mm-hmm.
But are they important to them? Certainly, if you were to wiki the names of any of the big Canadian, famed Canadian directors, Cronenberg through... Egoyan, McDonald, Bruce McDonald, you know, they all have accolades. They all have the list of... So obviously Canadian institutions are producing awards, and a lot of these, not a lot, a number of these awards are also American, so at some point somebody recognized them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't think the impetus for Canadian filmmaking is glamour.
Right. Yes, okay.
I don't think. But mm-hmm. I would stand corrected by any one of the people for whom I'm speaking mm-hmm. a little bit generally if any of them said, no, are you kidding me? I do this because I want an award.
Yeah.
I just want everyone to know my name. Could be.
We're just about out of time here.
Okay.
This is a totally fascinating discussion. Thank you for coming by.
Not at all.
How much longer do you think you're going to be working on your PhD?
I got about, I think, 3... Maybe 4, depends on how fast. You know, I wish I didn't even get a chance to talk with you. My other fields I worked in. My first master's degree is in theater history.
Mm-hmm.
I did some work on the Cube trilogy. That was initiated by a Canadian director named Vincenzo Natali. And I wanted to talk about, you know, I have a family of 7 kids. I wanted to tell you all sorts of personal stuff, but Canadian film ends up dominating any conversation that I have. And I deal with Canadian horror film as well. I'm finishing my comprehensive examinations, so that'll be at that for another 6 months.
Hmm.
And then dissertation, right? So in a fantasy world, 1.5 years to write that. In a realistic world, 3 years.
Hmm.
And then, so I would say I'm going to be here 3.5 more years.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so I'll come back.
Yeah,
you know.
Come back and we'll talk about all those other
we'll
things.
We'll talk more. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Jargon. If you want to listen again, go to our website, cfuv.uvic.ca, and click on the Listen tab.